for 132901, Green Grass versus International Monitor. Oh, hello. This Reeb or Ribe?
It's actually Rib, Your Honor.
Rib?
Yes. Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. I'm Attorney Erica Rib, and I represent the plaintiff appellant Celia Greengrass in this appeal of the District Court's grant of summary judgment on her Title VII retaliation case. We believe that the main question here today is whether or not Ms. Greengrass presented enough evidence that a reasonable trier of fact could determine that IMS retaliated against her for filing the EEOC claim and then lied about their reasons for actually putting her information in their SEC complaint. In order to establish a prima facie case of retaliation under Title VII, Ms. Greengrass has to show that there was protected activity, that she suffered an adverse action, and that there was a causal connection between those two.
What should we make of the fact that IMS seems to have treated all employee claims and all pending litigation disclosures in exactly the same way? When it disclosed names, it seems to have done so for all pending litigation. And when it stopped for all pending cases.
I believe that those are all retaliatory actions. Of course, only Ms. Greengrass's claim is here today, but I do not believe that this court should determine that just because they treated all employees in the same way, if you're treating them all in a discriminatory way, that should all be illegal. So it should not be a factor in this court's decision on Ms. Greengrass's specific case.
Where then is the evidence that the company purposely filed the SEC form with her name in it to harass her or to blacklist her?
Well, we believe that IMS had reached a point where they did not want further employees to file claims with the EEOC and other courts. They wanted to deter charging parties from enforcing their rights, and therefore they chose to do this. The evidence of that is we've used suspicious timing, ambiguous statements, as well as their pretextual reasons for filing with the SEC in the way that they did.
So you think they did it so all of them would be essentially blacklisted?
Yeah, and to deter
future employment.
To deter future charging parties from filing with them. I think they had, gotten enough complaints of one sort or another that they decided that, let's make these people an example that, you can't sue us or we're going to kind of publish this to the world. And I find that Ms. Greengrass's is more egregious because Ms. Greengrass, they said in their SEC filing that she had filed a meritless claim for sexual harassment. She didn't file a sexual harassment claim. She filed a sex discrimination, national origin discrimination, and retaliation claim. And the company had admitted months before that they had some potential liability in that case. So I believe that, and I don't know the details of the other two employees.
Yeah, that was my next question.
I do not know the details. So they could have admitted that there was potential liability. I simply don't know. As to the suspicious timing, IMS had made the point that there were 14 months between Ms. Greengrass's initial EEOC complaint and their first SEC filing that included her name and the fact that her claim was meritless. It's not the 14 months that we're really looking at. It wasn't until July of 2008, she filed her complaint in January of 2008. In July of 2008, they admitted they had some potential liability, but we're still, you can see through their in-house counsel's July 29th, 2008 email, that they basically weren't really worried about it because they didn't think that unless the EEOC took on Ms. Greengrass's case that she essentially had the means to fight a large legal battle, such as this. And then when they found out in January of 2009 that the EEOC was requesting to interview employees and that they might actually be taking this seriously and that IMS could face actual liability, it was that their next real opportunity to retaliate against her, their April 6, 2009 SEC filing that they chose to retaliate. So it's really that next opportunity to retaliate in which they did so.
And because in terms of the filings, they couldn't have done that earlier.
Right, their quarterly filing, there's a yearly filing and a quarterly filing. So there wasn't a filing to do in January as soon as they found out. It was their next opportunity to do so. We believe that the district court looked at questions of intent and decided them, which we did not feel it is appropriate on summary judgment. Ms. Greengrass has produced evidence to cast some serious doubt on IMS's explanation of why they put that information in their SEC filing. They have said that it was required, whereas Ms. Greengrass has pointed out that there are no real requirements that say first and last name in an evaluation of the case. IMS also, in order to put legal proceedings, to be required to put legal proceedings in your SEC filings, it needs to be material.
How do we get past the fact that the facts that you want us to take in her favor seem to be more conclusions based on speculation?
Well, Your Honor, I'm sorry.
It's, speculation about IMS's state of mind. The state of mind of the people in charge of IMS. Mm-hmm.
Well, we believe these questions of intent are for a jury. I did initially file a motion for summary judgment, which was potentially a little overzealous. So we are not asking you to decide that IMS discriminated against her. We're only asking that you return this for a jury to decide those questions of intent, and they can hear testimony and decide whether or not, the suspicious timing, the ambiguous statements, and of pretext are enough that they can determine that IMS did retaliate against Ms. Greengrass. I believe I was talking about the materiality. IMS admits that it did not do any kind of calculation as to whether or not it was material. So under the SEC doctrines, it's not required then to put that in their legal proceedings. As to pretext, IMS has also said they took the advice of their auditors when they put this in. However, between their auditors' advice on SEC disclosures on March 27th of 2008, after that, they filed three separate SEC filings in which they did not include the first and last name of Ms. Greengrass or anything, or that her claim was meritless. So we believe that this evidence casts serious doubt on whether or not those are genuine explanations.
Well, they maintain that they stopped doing it after they consulted with their auditors.
They actually first said that they did it because their auditors told them to, then that they stopped afterwards. And that may be true that they stopped afterwards, but we are looking at what we believe is retaliatory conduct in 2009. I see that I'm into my rebuttal time. If there are any questions, I'm happy to answer them. Otherwise, I would like to reserve the rest of my time.
Come on up, Mr. Rice.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the Court. I'm Sean Rice from Grafton, Wisconsin. I represent the Defendant International Monetary Systems Limited.
Do we have a definitive answer here about whether party names for pending litigation are required or not in SEC disclosure statements?
I think we do. The applicable SEC regulations and instructions instruct companies like IMS to disclose material legal proceedings and name principal parties. It's directly in the Regulation SK that's cited in our brief.
Uh-huh. Is there anything in the record about what the IMS auditors told IMS during its consultations that led it to believe that it didn't have to include party names in the SEC disclosure filings?
Well, throughout the time period that's relevant, IMS was relying on their advisors, including their auditors, as to how to disclose all kinds of issues in these disclosures, including the legal aspects or proceedings. There is plenty of evidence in the record as to the advice provided by the auditor and others as to how to word and the extent of disclosure required.
So the auditors changed their minds somewhere in the middle?
We will concede that the SEC regulations are not black and white. There's an opinion.
Yeah, because the same regulations were in effect when she filed her EEOC complaint, right? And there were several filings once she filed the EEOC complaint. At least there were four in 08. And then then we got to July.
That's correct. you have a small company seeking to comply with a federal regulation, and maybe in the abundance of caution, they disclosed all pending litigation they thought was material, and they disclosed it in a way they thought was compliant with the regulations, including naming principal parties, which is specifically stated in the regulation.
You know, I agree with you on the one hand that the Sklapsky email exchanges don't directly discuss any SEC filings or, in particular, retaliation against Ms. Greengrass. But on the other hand, they certainly do evince a certain culture, disrespect toward discrimination claims. And I'd like your take on whether or not that disrespectfulness can be part of what we consider when looking for the web of behavior or the mosaic, you know, that we look for in circumstantial cases.
Well, I would address that in a couple ways. One, as Judge Randa found, he considered those comments innocuous or innocent and not significant. I, as counsel who did not handle the trial, I'm not sure how attorney-client privilege communications became part of this record in the first place, but to your point, I don't think they rise to circumstantial evidence to support a finding that there was retaliation.
Well, listen, but Sklapsky emailed IMS management about the EEOC wanting other information on sexual harassment claims and speculating as to whether to disclose certain instances that the EEOC was calling for, that the problem with Greengrass, that she might know about it and she disclosed it. He didn't want the EEOC involved because it would force Greengrass to litigate on her limited resources and not get a large damage award because she couldn't afford a court fight.
Correct, and this is all in the context of they were being investigated by the EEOC.
Right.
This company is not familiar with these kind of procedures, and as I pointed out in my brief, they were not contemplating how to disclose their SEC disclosures about any of these cases and any of those comments or emails you have in the record.
But would you agree that IMS clearly has some sort of a problem? You know, this email exchange of how much they can hide?
I think it's an attorney trying to represent his client and maybe being a little frank in an email he never expected would be shared with it with this court especially, but they were defending several cases and claims at that time, and
but certainly on summary judgment, you know, you don't need evidence of a conclusive evidence. I mean, it seems to me there are disputed facts here in terms of, you know, because when you look at everything circumstantially, which is, of course, one of the ways that we look at it, there's something here.
Well, I would argue to the contrary. I think Judge Randa was correct that the fact that all the employees and claims were treated the same, there was no singling out of any employee, and the disclosures, all claimants were treated the same, whether their name was mentioned or not.
And these other employees, were they all female? Because when the EEOC found reasonable cause, that they found that there was reasonable cause to believe Greengrass and the other females as a class were subject to harassment and constructive discharge. So the other opposing counsel didn't know who they were, I think, or the nature of their claims. Weren't those claims from women as well in sexual harassment?
I'm not sure they all were. There were several. There were breach of contract claims. There were other pending litigation matters that were disclosed in the numerous.
Did all of them have sexual harassment or some sex discrimination aspect?
No, the disclosures at the time period relevant to this, no. There were other matters that were disclosed because they were required to, as litigation to be disclosed.
Well, the disclosures, did they all relate to individuals of the female persuasion?
No, as I said, I believe there was at least one about a breach of contract. Basically,
but were they all women?
Women. Were they all women?
I'm not sure, but I don't think so.
Because I'm just saying to suggest when you look at what the EEOC found in terms of probable cause, they mentioned Greenspan and they mentioned the other females as a class that were subject to harassment and constructively discharged.
There were other EEOC claims, and there was a state employment claim, but there were also other pending litigation matters that the company felt they had to disclose.
But you're unsure as to whether those were men or not?
Not knowing all those cases.
You can't say. I understand.
I would also just point out to the court that despite the issues of we think there's no suspicious timing and that the statements don't support a finding of circumstantial evidence, we emphasize that we believe we had an obligation to disclose these pending litigation files, and also that there's a qualified immunity essentially for the company if they're going to comply with the SEC disclosure laws. We think it's unjust and inequitable to be liable for a statement that was made in the context of requiring with a SEC federal law and the securities laws that we'd be pointed out to the court.
Have you finished all talking?
That's all I have.
Sit down, well, and bye.
Equal opportunity timekeeping.
There you go.
Thank you,
Mr. Rice.
May it please the court. I have a few follow-ups.
How much time does she have? 2 minutes.
Okay. I would like to
and
again.
You've got an enforcer
okay,
to my
I will
right.
be quick. I promise. I would like to again address that, you know, although they've said that, you know, they disclosed these because they felt they were obligated under the SEC because it was a material legal proceeding, there is no evidence that they did any computation that it's material. Also, they stopped doing it and have not done it thus far, you know, until now. They're still not putting anybody's name in it. I would like to emphasize the importance of their in-house counsel's comments, his emails, that although Judge Randa dismissed them as innocuous, we believe that was a judgment call.
You don't have to talk that fast.
Okay, I'm very sorry.
I have to understand you.
Okay. I wanted to emphasize the importance of their in-house counsel, Mr. Sklapsky's emails, because he made all of those comments, and he is the one that provided the information to be included in the SEC filings under the legal proceedings. He sent an email on March 26, 2009, saying, this is what is happening, this is what you should include, and that's exactly what they included. As to the qualified immunity argument, I do not believe it was briefed at this level. It was briefed in the district court, and our response to that can be found in our reply appendix at page 48. And we simply don't believe that qualified immunity applies, and that even if it did, because they inaccurately represented that what her claim actually was, that it was a sexual harassment claim when it was not, as well as the fact that they're saying it was meritless when they had already admitted they had potential liability.
And it doesn't seem like there was any consulting with the auditors at the time she filed the complaint or for that whole year in terms of how to comply with the filing requirement and whether the names had to be disclosed.
They did ask their auditor about that on March 27th, 2008, and the auditor replied and gave them some options, and then they filed three separate SEC filings after that that did not include the
names.
And
those options the auditor gave were?
It was just kind of how to name it. One was just former employer. One did include the names but did not mention it was meritless. I see that my time is up. If there are no further questions,
Thank you.
Would, again, request that this be remanded to the district court for trial. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, and thank you very much. Case will be taken under advisement.